that give forth that wonderful phrase. To hear those three little words.
Patricia T. O'Connor is here. She is once every month. We talk about the English language when she's here, and she has written about the language in a number of books. Woe is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origin of the Specious. There is the Woe is I version for kids, Woe is I Junior. There have been some updated versions because the language keeps on changing.
Yes.
And so if you are looking for those books, look for the latest edition, or maybe you want to find out what the language was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and
sure.
Look for earlier
Buy
editions.
Buy one on eBay.
We have asked our listeners to come up with some of the phrases that you find that have become journalistic cliches.
Mm-hmm.
And we got a whole bunch on Facebook. But it's something that I think a lot about because it's very easy to slip into some of those phrases.
It is. And the kinds of cliches that I like to collect are the ones that show the press's ability to come up with some formulaic adjectival description for almost anybody or anything. Now, I first noticed this during the first Gulf War when I was still working as a newspaper editor. And it occurred to me that Kuwait was never just plain Kuwait. It was always oil-rich Kuwait. Mm-hmm. And it still is to this day. If you Google it, people are still calling it oil-rich Kuwait. It's been 20 years now.
We don't say oil-rich Saudi Arabia, which is
no.
much richer in oil.
Right.
And Kuwait, in fact, an argument could be made that they were stealing their oil from Iraq, which is one of the reasons Saddam Hussein invaded in the
right.
first place.
Right, but it was always oil-rich Kuwait. And another example, Bosnia was never just Bosnia. It was always war-torn Bosnia. And any region fighting for its independence was bound to be called a breakaway republic.
Mm-hmm.
These were things you only saw in the newspaper or heard on the news. And this worked for people, too. And I think perhaps the chief example of a person who got attached to a formulaic phrase was Manuel Noriega, who was never just Manuel Noriega. He was always Panamanian strongman Manuel Noriega. Now, what's the strongman thing? What does this mean? I always imagined him bench pressing or lifting weights or working out or something in his little champion muscle shirt. But, long after he was out of commission and sitting helplessly in jail, people were still calling him a strongman, although he was usually ex-Panamanian strongman or former or one-time or deposed. But journalists just couldn't let go of the strongman thing.
And not just Noriega. They did
right.
it with Slobodan Milosevic.
Yes, for a while.
Serbian strongman.
You're right. He was called Serbian strongman Slobodan Milosevic. And for a while we had, I think we still once in a while ran across Venezuelan strongman Hugo Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Noriega still holds the title for most strongman references. But if you recall, the world of finance is really full of these kinds of things. Remember fugitive financier Robert Vesco? He was always fugitive financier. And he was succeeded, of course, by fugitive financier Mark Rich. But if the guy who's in trouble isn't a fugitive, you see, if he's not hiding out somewhere, the journalists have to come up with something else, so which they did in the case with Michael Milken, who became junk bond king, Michael Milken. And he's still referred to that way.
Well, it's interesting that in many cases, this is universal. Everybody
oh,
uses
yes.
those things. In other cases, only some publications use them. For example, TimeSpeak had its mm-hmm. own version of this. Sometimes what they came up with was picked up by others. The New York Post has been particularly fecund in this area.
Uh-huh.
In fact, we asked listeners to send in some suggestions of this sort of thing. And she
uh-huh.
says, can you guess which tabloid I'm citing when I say Alec Baldwin described as a bloviator and Monica Lewinsky as a portly pepper pot?
Portly pepper pot, which reminds me, I think a lot of these phrases depend on alliteration.
Mm-hmm.
For their catchiness. even when you think of Panamanian strongman, Manuel Noriega, he's got all these M's and N's in there. So I think portly pepper pot Monica Lewinsky is along those same lines.
But then there are other things where it seems to just have occurred to me, even though everybody else has said it, like, as Barry List points out, former Maverick Senator John McCain.
Oh, yes. Why is he former Maverick?
Because he used to be a Maverick, and now he seems to be conforming to the Republican line. But everybody says the same thing, a man who presented himself as a Maverick. And now they're saying, well, but he's now voting against the, you know, a bill that he once supported.
Yeah.
Then there's another listener sends in, Molly Adams says, I'm already sick of shellacking.
Oh, yes, shellacking. That's a good one.
And Betsy Rappaport says, Charles Rangel of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee.
Yes, that's another one. Stuart pointed that one out to me. You never see Ways and Means Committee without powerful in front of it. But politics is full of those. You know, when candidates are campaigning in Ohio, for example, they're never in Ohio. They're in the Buckeye State. Or when they're traveling around the state, they aren't just traveling around. They are crisscrossing the state, or they are taking the pulse of voters, or they are saturating the airwaves, or they are amassing fat campaign war chests. I mean, the cliches just go on and on and on. And that's one of the reasons why I think everyone breathes such a sigh of relief at the end of each election cycle. You just got so sick of this stuff.
What's the alternative? It's just so easy to slip into those things, and they are effective, and usually, in many cases anyway, they're accurate.
Well, you know,
they did saturate the airwaves.
I think they've lost their effectiveness. You get so used to hearing saturate the airwaves that you think it just means, oh, the guy bought a few ads. You don't really think of saturated airwaves. The thing loses its vividness after about 200,000 uses, you know?
Do you have any others before we go to the calls?
Well, I did want to mention a couple of other just general ones. For instance, companies get these kinds of monikers. Do you remember back when Apple introduced a new product that instantly became known as Apple's ill-fated Lisa?
Mm.
It was always ill-fated Lisa. It went viral, so to speak. I mean, it was just everywhere.
They didn't do that to the Edsel.
No, they just never said ill-fated.
No,
Edsel.
Because Edsel meant ill-fated.
Yes, it was incorporated into the name. And whenever Microsoft is mentioned, it's always called the software giant. Or whenever Walmart is mentioned, it's always world's largest retailer. And another one that always kills me is Catholics are always referred to, or someone who's Catholic is always referred to as a devout Catholic. You never hear of a devout Presbyterian or a devout Jew. It's always
a devout evangelical.
Yes, right. Catholics, there are no semi-enthusiastic Catholics. They are all devout.
No, I think that the reason for that, well, you would never say devout evangelical because of the implication is that evangelicals are devout. In the case of Catholics, this is a pretty broad tent, and not all Catholics are devout. So we're talking about somebody who is following the church's teachings pretty much 100%.
Well, I think reporters and journalists generally use it loosely for any Catholic. So-and-so is a devout Catholic. It just goes along with the adjective just slips right in there. Like one man with a gun is always going to be called a lone gunman.
Right.
They'll never say a guy with a gun. It's always a lone gunman. An underdressed woman is always scantily clad.
Of course.
You know, there are all these phrases just come right onto the keyboard when journalists are at work and bam, and there they are. Just read them over and over again. Oh, another one I like is when there's an accident, say an airline crashes or something, the journalist will never say something went wrong. He or she will write something went terribly wrong, or even terribly, terribly wrong.
Should we take a call?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Andrew from the West Village, you're on the air. Andrew, you have to turn off your radio. You're getting confused. Okay, well, can I think everybody is alerted to the fact that we're on a slight delay, And if you are going to come on the air, if you want to come on the air, please stick to your phone because you're just going to hear us on your radio about.
Is that, let something bad slip out? You can
zap it? The FCC is so has been so hard on people who have inadvertently allowed mm-hmm. callers or anyone else to say mm-hmm. something that is no longer accepted. That we all live in fear. We live in terror.
So you're is that living a cliche? In a delay. Yes, you live in terror, which is better than clinging to
welcome back.
Hi, thank you very much. I have two things. One's pertinent, and the other one is slightly off. I love disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff.
Oh.
That's good. Uh-huh. And then the other one, I don't know if this is the grammar show, but one thing that people keep saying is, the thing is. And that uh-huh. really drives me nuts. And even Obama says that. So uh-huh. I wish we could extract that from our lexicon, but it's made it in.
Right.
I know it's off topic, but I had to.
No, this is a
language
program.
We have discussed this in the past.
Sure. That's called a double copula when you have the two is's. And I think what happens is people start to speak, they say the thing is, and then the rest of the clause hasn't been planned ahead of time. And they'll say, is I was late or something like that. So it's just it's poor planning.
But it's not bad English.
Well, yeah, it is. It's non-standard English, yeah.
Oh, by the way, another listener sends in, Kimberly Bryan Smith, battling cancer.
Oh, yes, yes.
People always battle cancer.
Battle cancer, which reminds me of another journalistic cliche. You know, you remember Generalissimo Francisco Franco?
How can we forget? He's still
he
dead.
He was ailing. He was the ailing dictator for so long. There were daily updates, and they ran out of ways to phrase these daily updates. He was always clinging to life, battling for his life, struggling to hold on. And, of course, we never really knew because of the Spanish censors, but people were really struggling to come up with ways to couch these news bulletins every day. But he was always the ailing 82-year-old dictator or whatever he was. And then it was such a vacuum when he did die that Saturday Night Live had to come up with that still dead news bulletin.
Our number here, by the way, is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. And you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. We're going to take a little break and come back with more of your calls and comments to Patricia T. O'Connor, who visits us once a month to talk about the English language. Stay with us.
To hear those three little words. Man, that's such a wonderful
thing. We're back with Patricia T. O'Connor, and we're taking your calls at 646-829, and then I have forgotten the rest of the phone number. Oh, 3985. You know, suddenly these things just...
Well, they were replaced by cliches in your mind.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about a comment left by Dan from Manhattan on our show page. What's up with news commentator CNN is the worst offender saying drill down on a story?
Drill down.
Have you heard that one?
No, I haven't.
Well, then there's always billionaire George Soros. Nobody ever would just say George Soros.
Right. Now, to be a true cliched catchphrase, it has to have a phrase, not just one word, I think. So it would have to be like outrageous billionaire George Soros or filthy rich billionaire. Yeah.
Well, they don't say
like that.
But Mike and Tribeca points out that people always say there was an outpouring of support.
Oh, outpouring of support is one of my favorites. And it's also the other variation on that is an outpouring of grief. Like when someone is shot in a high school, for example, the kids have an outpouring of grief, and they are overwhelmed with an outpouring of support from the residents of the community, who are always, of course, concerned residents, not just residents, concerned residents.
We have a call off this topic, which is fine because we talk about a lot of different things, from Jack from Ridgewood. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? Yeah, some words that were really in fashion, and then they just disappeared. It's like losing an old friend. And the one from quite a while ago that one seemed to read quite often was shibboleth. I don't think I've seen shibboleth. I don't know when.
Oh.
And one more recently. Like
I saw her at
a
party recently.
Pardon?
Go ahead.
And one more recently, like a couple of years ago, was Schadenfreude, and that seems to have disappeared,
no,
too.
It's still
no, that's around.
You're
that's
just hanging
around.
Out with a different crowd.
Right, yeah.
But there are words that I won't say on the air, for example. I will, I read them, but I would never say out loud, eschew, for example.
Oh, eschew.
Yeah, eschew.
Yes, yes.
Because nobody
this
ever says eschew.
I know.
And I've stopped saying fort because everybody else says forte. And when I say fort, they look at me like I'm crazy.
Right. Because if you say something really correctly, you're showing off. You know?
You're eschewing off. Well, anyway.
No, those words are still around.
Yeah. We have Patrick from Brooklyn with a very deep question. Hi, Patrick.
Hi. How are you?
Okay. What's your question?
Well, the thing is, you know, we always talk about how, you know, Romance languages are connected, like Spanish and French and Italian and things like that. And I love to learn languages. But, like, where is English really originated from? Is it, like, really Germanic? Is it more Nordic? Like, where? What's the real root of English?
It's in the Germanic Germanic family.
Well, isn't it a mix because you have the Angles and the Saxons coming
from
Denmark and whatever, and they're Germanic. And then, then William the Conqueror brings French in, and so we have a fusion.
Right, but no one would argue that at our foundation isn't as a Germanic language. And all those languages of Northeastern Europe and the Scandinavian countries are all classed as Germanic. So we're a Germanic language. Now, we've been influenced a lot by Latin in vocabulary, and there were attempts in the 18th and 19th centuries to impose Latin grammar onto English, but that hasn't worked. We're a Germanic language through and through, which is why a lot of what used to be considered rules of grammar are no more.
And then English is enriched by the fact that we take from everybody.
We do.
So we'll take words like pajamas from India or something.
India, yeah. We've got words from
orange
everywhere.
Comes from the Naranja, Spanish,
right? We're very broad-minded about that. I was just reading the other day that Spain. Spanish has an academy for almost every major city in Spain. It has something like 20-some academies. France has an academy, of course. There were attempts to impose an academy on English several hundred years ago. Nobody really went for it, so that idea never went over.
And that's why we don't have the struggle over introducing new words. We're perfectly happy to welcome them.
Right. What works gets adopted. And also, what works may not have worked a century ago, but it may be considered terrific now. For instance, the word agenda, which was a plural word in the 19th century, now means something different, means a list.
Well, are you okay with all of those changes? For example, media, which is a plural, and I still use it that way. But many people say the media is.
Right. Actually, media now has two senses. It has a singular and a plural meaning. Media, plural, being the various
mediums
of communication, and media being a reference to the communications industry as a whole, just as we use data now in a singular way to mean information as a whole.
And we've gotten around the word memorandum by saying memo.
Yes.
Let's take another call. Nick from Long Island, you're on the air.
Yes, you often hear the phrase born again Christian.
Mm-hmm.
I never, to my knowledge, have heard the phrase born again Jew.
Well, there's a good reason for that, Nick, because there's a process by which Christians, some Christians, become born again.
Right. I think it's tied up with belief in baptism and whatnot.
Well, you take Jesus to be your personal Savior, and you could be rebaptized, and you go through a whole process of being in the thinking of people who practice that. You are born again.
Uh-huh. But I think that the phrase born again has become broadened a bit to include other things, to include any process by which you come back to something.
Mm-hmm.
But that's different than reborn. I've heard people call themselves, but it means coming back to something. Like you might say McCain is a born-again moderate Republican instead of a renegade maverick or whatever. And you might say somebody is a born-again atheist. If he was once an atheist, then became baptized and then said, oh, the hell with it, I'm being an atheist again. You could call him a born-again atheist. In other words, the phrase born-again is being used loosely to just mean...
But then following what Nick is saying, there are people who come back to their religion, whatever it is.
Sure.
Jewish people do. But we don't say that they were born again. They just say that he's become more Orthodox or he is...
Or Catholics talk about coming home again to the faith. Meaning when you were a kid, you always went to Mass and then you fell away from it. And now later in life, you're starting to go to Mass again. You've come home again. So there are different ways of referring to all this.
A couple of listeners have cited the word iconic as words that they've heard enough of. Stanley Mises wrote it in on Facebook, and we just got a comment from Karen in Manhattan. She says it's applied to everything from Lady Gaga to handbags.
Well, I want to say something about iconic. I do get once in a while complaints from people who say iconic refers to something that has religious import. Well, it didn't always have that meaning. Its original meaning was just an image. An icon is only a representation, an image of something, a portrait. It didn't have religious significance until about the 19th century.
But an iconoclast, so that goes back earlier, which is people who are against images.
I'm not sure,
I'm sure
how,
it's a pretty
how
old, word.
Old that is. Yeah? Well, the reason iconic became associated with religion is because people started using the term religious icon to refer to religious portraits.
Yeah.
And then
there were the Russian
icons,
the Byzantine icons.
Right. And icons then started, an icon meant some religious representation, but it wasn't always.
Well, look up iconoclast because I'm curious about that. I'm happy to be wrong. I've been wrong before.
No,
in my
you're
life.
Not.
No, I am. I can handle it. Let's take another call while you're looking.
Okay.
Linda from Princeton. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, Linda.
Hi. Two questions. What was the origin of Good Samaritan when Samaritans had formerly been called Samaritans, and there was a differentiation between the good and the bad, I imagine. And the other thing is...
Let's stop with that.
Yeah.
Right.
Isn't that redundant, Good Samaritan?
Well,
and yet
no.
We say it.
No, because the original Good Samaritan was a person from Samaria. Am I saying that correctly?
I guess.
Was a Samaritan, and he did a good deed. So that made him a good Samaritan. Now we've sort of conflated those ideas, but Samaritan didn't always mean someone who does a good deed. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It was like saying the good Philadelphian, if he had been from Philadelphia.
There are good Philadelphians?
And could I ask you another one?
Sure.
When I've noticed recently in weather reports, there are meteorologists who will say there's a risk of a thunderstorm. I thought it used to be there's a threat. It's like risk means we could do something about it to lessen the odds.
I suppose the only thing you can do is stay inside. But I don't know. Weather reporting is its own animal. My favorite thing I ever heard on the Weather Channel was a snowstorm was forecast, and the announcer said that everyone who was on the road should be careful driving to or from his destination.
My favorite morning newscaster will always say, well, alternate side of the street rules are suspended, but you have to feed the meters.
Oh.
You have to feed the meters. These are things that we all slide into. I know I do. Do you feed the meter?
I don't know.
Okay, well, we won't.
I was reading about iconoclasts, and I was sort of.
And what does it say?
Well, an icon is from the Greek icon, E-I-K-O-N, if you spell it in English. An image or likeness. Klastes meant breaker, from a verb meaning to break. So an iconoclast, someone who breaks an image. But in iconoclasts, when it was first used, the images referred to were religious images, which were used in the 8th and 9th century when iconoclasm was at its height. So they were breaking religious images. It's true. The icon. You're right. The early iconoclasts were breaking religious images, but icon did not always mean a religious image.
And then there's Carl Icahn, and we won't even go into that.
financier Carl Icahn. No, he was never a fugitive.
Pat has answers to frequently asked questions as a sidebar under features on our show page at WNYC.org. Do you want to talk about those FAQs?
Oh, the FAQs. Well, I did those because it seemed that a lot of people were asking the same questions over and over when calling into WNYC, so we thought maybe it would be helpful to put those in writing and have them so that people could just click on them. And it's things like less versus fewer, saying ask as acts, those sorts of things. And I think there are 30 or 35 of those, but it might be interesting for some of the listeners to check on those and see if any of their commonly asked questions are in there.
And if they have some other suggestions,
oh,
they
yeah,
can send
I'd be
them
happy
to you as well.
Happy to put those in.
You can be reached at
grammarphobia.com. We have a blog there. My husband, Stuart Kellerman, and I have a blog, and we answer questions. Most of them seem to be from WNYC listeners, and we answer one question every day. I think today we did one about HIP, the origin of HIP, which came up last time we were on the air. And there's a common myth about that the expression hip came from the practice of opium smokers of lying on one hip while smoking in an opium den. I hadn't either, but it's quite a popular etymology. It turns out not to be true, though, because it was first recorded in 1921 and hip had been around since almost the turn of the century.
Well, I would think it came out of hep.
Well,
like hepcat.
Hip and hep, there's no telling which of those came first because they both arrived at about the same time. So it's difficult to say.
A listener, Allison in Greenpoint, wondered about the origin of the phrase pipe dream since you're talking about this. I would assume pipe dream comes out of smoking opium.
Smoking opium? I would think so. I haven't heard that. I haven't checked that out to find out whether it's true, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Joe from Queens, you're on the air. Joe, are you there?
Something that seems to be common with people under the age of 30, when you go to interact with them and you say thank you, instead of saying you're welcome, lately everyone seems to say no problem.
Mm-hmm. Or no prob.
No prob.
No prob. You
right.
know, what happened to your welcome? Or if somebody didn't hear you the first time, instead of saying, I beg your pardon, or what did you say, they go, what happened?
Oh, yes, I've been asked both of those questions. I hadn't heard before. I've never been asked what happened when somebody didn't hear me the first time. But apparently, that's quite common. I think it's among people who are like half my age. But
what about no problem? Is it something like de nada?
Yes. When Stuart and I researched No Problem for our blog, we found that there's a corresponding phrase in almost every language, even pas de problème, no problema.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unusual to English. And
so people are probably just translating that other response in another language.
Well, either that, or you could say that there's some instinctive response there, that when someone says thank you, you're saying there was no difficulty involved. It wasn't a problem for me. So.
And now I have a problem. We're running out of time.
Oh.
But I want to remind listeners that Pat will be back with us on December 15th, and you can write to her meanwhile at mailbox@grammarphobia.com. You can also click on Pat's blog at grammarphobia.com to see a selection of language questions from WNYC listeners. And a reminder, you can also check out her books, Woe Is I, Words Fail Me, You Send Me, Origin of the Species, and Woe Is I, Junior. Pat, thank you so much for being with us again.
No problem.